headlines. President Rouhani says Iran will return to its nuclear commitments once sanctions are lifted, as repeatedly stressed by the country's leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. The Taliban reject the Afghan president's proposal for elections later this year, saying any such decision should be made in talks between the two sides. And several European countries, including Poland, Bulgaria, and Ukraine, report their highest number of coronavirus cases and deaths in months. Our top story for this half hour: Iran's President Hassan Rouhani has pledged a full return to the 2015 nuclear deal once all sanctions against the country are lifted.
If the other party, which is all the P5 plus one member states, decide to implement all of their commitments and lift the sanctions, as our leader stressed on several occasions, and it becomes clear to us that they are serious in this, we will also return to all our commitments under the nuclear deal.
Rouhani said despite the 3 years of injustice imposed on Tehran, Iran is ready to fully return to the nuclear agreement without claiming for any loss or damage at the moment. He noted that the remarks made by Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei were very clear and left the other side no excuse on the issue. Iran started to scale down its commitments under the accord a year after the U.S. unilaterally pulled back from the landmark agreement in May 2018 and reimposed sanctions against Tehran. Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says adopting political positions regarding the 2015 nuclear deal is counterproductive. Qasem Gharibabadi says using outdated allegations against Iran will not justify the agency's deliberate failure in addressing other proliferation issues, such as Israel's nuclear status. The Iranian official made the comment in reaction to a recent interview by the IAEA chief with Newsweek. Rafael Grossi had called for a detailed and technical discussions regarding the presence of uranium particles at undeclared locations in Iran. Gharibabadi said such interviews can narrow the chances of success in the agency's future initiatives. Tehran and IAEA have reached a temporary deal for 3 months and will decide on further cooperation afterwards. The Taliban militant group has rejected an early presidential election proposal that Afghan President Ashraf Ghani is reportedly set to unveil next month. The Taliban say they will not support Ghani's proposal, calling the elections a scandalous process in the country. The group says such a decision should be made in talks between the two sides. Two government officials said on Tuesday that President Ghani will announce the election plan at a conference in Turkey next month. According to the officials, the election will be held within 6 months. Ghani's effort is seen as a counteroffer to a U.S. proposal for the formation of an interim government involving the Taliban before American troops leave the country by May the 1st. Yemeni parties and political activists have held a gathering in the capital Sana'a to mark the 6th anniversary of the Saudi-led aggression on their country. A number of party representatives and activists addressed the event, dubbed 6 years of resistance. The speaker slammed Saudi Arabia's ongoing military campaign and demanded an end to the invasion. One activist said, "Innocent people in Yemen are being killed, while the world only looks on." He said, "Yemeni forces will keep protecting the nation and its honor against invaders." Another speaker said the Saudi aggression is tantamount to war against humanity. The Arab Kingdom and some of its allies launched a war against Yemen in March 2015. The campaign has left tens of thousands dead and millions displaced.
The war on Yemen is escalating like never before. When Saudi Arabia launched what it described as a three-week offensive back in March 2015, it bombed and bombed and carried on bombing with the stated aim of bringing back to power Yemen's former president Abd Rabbuh Mansour Hadi, despite his term ending in 2014. His refusal to leave power triggered a popular uprising. Till this day, Saudi warplanes continue their airstrikes, hitting funerals, weddings, school buses, and even hospitals. Nothing has been spared. Rights groups accuse the Saudi regime of war crimes. And as the war enters its seventh year, Yemeni forces are fighting back and hitting the Saudis where it hurts on an almost daily basis. Under a tight blockade, Yemen has built indigenous missiles and drones that are targeting Saudi oil facilities deep inside the kingdom. Analysts believe Saudi Arabia is trying to avoid humiliation and has therefore put forward a ceasefire proposal, the second in less than a year, an offer that Yemen has rejected.
The problem with this so-called new Saudi peace proposal is that there is nothing new about it. It doesn't really go beyond, at least at the initial release in the beginning of the day, the statement of the Saudis didn't go beyond any basic, you know, platitudes of peace and negotiation and, you know, trying to end the war through political talks, without really going into the details as to how Saudi Arabia wants to achieve this. Yes, the Saudis say that they want to reopen Sana'a Airport, that they want to end the blockade in Hodeidah Seaport, but there is not really a clear condition that will allow Yemen to really reinvigorate and relive.
A spokesman for the Popular Ansar Allah movement says Yemen is ready to enter a political dialogue after Saudi Arabia stops the war and lifts its siege on Yemen. Mohammed Abdel Salam says putting forward ideas that have been discussed for over a year now is nothing new. Yemeni drones and missiles are also striking Saudi military bases where warplanes take off to carry out their air raids. On the ground itself, Yemeni forces are close to capturing the gas and oil-rich city of Ma'rib from Saudi-backed militants loyal to the former Yemeni government.
Ma'rib is located in the center of Yemen, in the historical heartland of Yemen as well. And so for them, this is a very important base of operation. So if they lose Ma'rib, they're basically losing all control over the front lines in which they are fighting against the troops of the National Salvation Government in central Yemen. So that is why this negotiation is basically, this plan, I think, is basically coming forth out of a fear to lose Ma'rib.
Ma'rib is strategically located near the Saudi border. It is the last main area that Saudi-backed forces control. Should Yemeni forces take control of the city, it will strike a heavy blow to Riyadh. In essence, the tables have turned. The offensive that would take 3 weeks has turned into a pipe dream.
Yemen's Supreme Political Council has denounced the Saudi ceasefire offer, saying there were expectations to at least lift the siege on Hodeidah. The strategic port city accounts for 90% of Yemen's imports, including vital commodities such as food and fuel. The Saudi blockade on Yemen has led to the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. The Saudi proposal offers to ease this on the condition that Yemeni forces end their military operations first. However, Sana says lifting the siege must be a precondition for any deal.
Saudi Arabia has resumed its aerial assaults using Western-made weapons. Human rights groups, as well as observers on the ground, say many of these airstrikes are inaccurate, indiscriminate, and hit residential areas, killing civilians. Rights groups and international bodies say Western countries are complicit in Saudi war crimes by selling hundreds of billions of dollars worth of arms to the kingdom, as well as assisting Riyadh with intelligence and training for its pilots. Ansar Allah says it and allied forces have no option but to expand their retaliatory operations against targets inside Saudi Arabia and to, quote, liberate every inch of the country's soil through armed struggle. So the Saudi war in Yemen continues. Since the truce offer, Yemeni forces have hit Saudi targets and, not for the first time, have also brought down an American reconnaissance drone. It has left many asking if the ceasefire proposal was an admission of defeat by the Saudis.
Definitely is. It is a start of Saudi Arabia coming to terms with the fact that they, I would say diplomatically, that they might not lose, not win this war, but I think it's pretty certain to say that they will not win this war. But this is a Vietnam War kind of scenario that Saudi Arabia has really sunk itself into the swamp of trying to conquer, trying to subdue, trying to dominate and subjugate Yemen.
Saudi Arabia appears to be stuck in a quagmire. Analysts have described the ceasefire offer as a public relations exercise to portray Yemeni forces as the aggressors while the kingdom seeks a way out of the costly military disaster it created both in Yemen and back at home.
A United Nations special rapporteur says a top Saudi official has issued a death threat against her for investigating the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Agnes Callamard said she was alerted by her colleagues that in January 2020, a senior Saudi official had twice threatened to have her taken care of. She said her colleagues perceived the message as a death threat. Callamard was the first official to publicly investigate and publish a detailed report into the 2018 murder of Khashoggi. She published a 100-page report in June 2019, concluding that there was credible evidence the Saudi crown prince and other officials were liable for the killing. Khashoggi was killed and dismembered inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul in October 2018. Elsewhere, the coronavirus pandemic keeps spreading across the world despite vaccination campaigns and restrictions in a majority of virus-hit countries. India has reported 275 more deaths and over 47,000 new infections. The country's total caseload is now over 11.7 million, just behind the U.S. and Brazil. The disease is also taking its toll on Europe, with Poland reporting 575 more deaths, the highest this year. Bulgaria confirmed nearly 5,000 new cases, its highest daily tally on record. Ukraine has also reported a new daily high of 342 deaths. It has registered over 1.5 million infections and more than 30,000 deaths so far. Less than 5% of the population in the European Union has been fully vaccinated for COVID-19. A top EU official has blamed pharmaceutical firm AstraZeneca for the damage done to the bloc's reputation. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Legislators from across the EU's 27 countries say citizens' patience has run out as hundreds of millions wait to be called for a COVID-19 vaccine. AstraZeneca is to deliver 170 million fewer doses than promised during the next 3 months.
It's absolutely shame. We have to be absolutely clear and stop it. Stop it. With AstraZeneca, with these dirty tricks, we cannot accept it.
The Director General of the European Commission's Health Division, Sandra Galina, moved to shift any blame from her institution during the debate in the European Parliament, Brussels.
This bad performance of AstraZeneca has created a reputational issue for all of us, be it the Commission or the Member States.
But lawmakers say the European Commission waited too long to sign contracts with vaccine producers. The debate was told less than 5% of the EU's population have received the required two jabs of approved vaccines. The bloc citizens are taking note, according to experts.
Huge popular waves of Euroscepticism, lack of trust in national institutions, European institutions, in leaders.
Russia's highly effective vaccine, Sputnik V, was the first in the world to be approved for mass use. However, the EU appears to have snubbed it.
Do you agree the approval process should be based on efficacy and safety in terms of health outcomes and not geopolitics?
Lawmakers have been quizzing the European Medicines Agency about slow vaccine approvals. The US and UK inoculation programmes are making the EU look like a joke, it was suggested.
We have been using a more stringent approach and rigorous approach than the emergency use authorizations that a number of other countries have done.
Critics say the EU's threat to ban vaccine exports to Britain is petty and a sign of desperation. A third wave of coronavirus is taking hold in several EU countries, forcing businesses to remain closed. lawmakers claim populist parties across the bloc are waiting in the wings to take advantage of the health, social and economic crises.
They argue that if the EU falls apart as a result, the powers that be will only have themselves to blame. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has survived a no-confidence vote in Parliament. The vote came after a parliamentary committee investigating a sexual harassment scandal involving Sturgeon's predecessor, Alex Salmond, found that it had been misled by testimony from the First Minister. Saipurza reports from London.
The Scottish First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, last week, when excerpts of the Parliamentary Committee report came out.
I think the first thing to say is I stand by all of the evidence I gave to the committee. This leak from the committee, very partisan leak, tonight, before they've actually finalised the report, is not that surprising. So let's wait and see the final report.
That final report is out today. And accuses her of misleading Parliament by unknowingly giving an inaccurate account of her dealings with her mentor Alex Salmond in 2018.
What it is really a parliamentary game. I think at the beginning of this, they really hoped they were going to get Nicola Sturgeon. And if they could get Nicola Sturgeon, that would drive into support both for the Scottish National Party and for a further independence referendum.
But the findings of the committee's report contradict those of an inquiry carried out by prominent lawyer James Hamilton, the man Sturgeon herself asked to investigate her actions on what she knew and when, whether she violated the rules by not recording her meetings with Salmond on the complaints against him, whether she acted inappropriately by resisting Salmond's call for her to stop the sexual harassment investigation, and whether her government should have conceded the case against Salmond earlier to save public money after he successfully challenged in court the Scottish government's handling of his case and was awarded £500,000. Hamilton's verdict, published a day earlier, not guilty on all four counts. After she won a vote of no confidence in the Scottish Parliament today, Sturgeon and her supporters say they want to draw the line under the Salmond controversy and move on. Her critics disagree. They allege the inquiry didn't look at further potential breaches of the ministerial code and that Sturgeon's government badly let down women at the heart of it all.
Both the Conservatives and the Labour MPs who are on this committee are still sticking to this agenda of trying to force Nicola Sturgeon out in order to damage the SNP.
The question on the minds of many now is what impact the Salmond saga will have on Nicola Sturgeon's Scottish National Party's chances of winning May's parliamentary elections and her plans to hold a second referendum on independence from the rest of the UK. Saipurza, London.
North Korea has test-fired two short-range missiles at the weekend. That's what neighboring South Korea and the United States say. South Korea's military says two cruise missiles were fired off the North's west coast on Sunday. U.S. officials have downplayed the missile firing, saying they are not covered by U.N. Security Council resolutions that ban tests. The launches mark North Korea's first weapons test since U.S. President Joe Biden took office in January. Reacting to the news, Biden has said he does not consider the firing as provocation. Biden has said his administration is open to dialogue with North Korea about the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. But according to U.S. officials, Pyongyang has not responded to Washington's behind-the-scenes diplomatic push for talks since mid-February. That's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the eighth session of the Assembly.
For example, the Islamic government is faced with conditional pressures imposed by the enemy. So, when such an issue arises, the concept of Therefore, stand firm in the straight path as you are commanded. You and those who with you turn unto Allah becomes completely clear to us. Before the emergence of such issues, it is not completely clear to us. The phrase, and those who with you turn unto Allah, meaning that the people should stand firm, is a general rule. But when such a situation arises, we understand its meaning specifically and exactly. Today, we are faced with such an issue. Our people have certain problems, part of which results from the pressures exerted by the enemy. Therefore, we want the people to stand firm in the face of these problems. This is a great and important movement that is thankfully being launched in our country.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Me faith to be stronger among
to madami ke jibhe مرکب دشمن جبهه شیطان که مرکب از شیاطین مختلفه در مقابل انسان قرار نگرفته و انسان از همه طرف محاصره نشده معنای این آیه رو درست نمیفهمه که ولما را المؤمنون الاحزاب قالوا هذا ما وعدنا الله ورسوله وصدق الله ورسوله وما زادهم الا ایمانا وتسلیما.
Another example is that as long as the enemy's miscellaneous front, the camp of the shaitan composed of various devils, does not confront us, and as long as we are not besieged from all sides, we do not correctly understand the meaning of this ayah. When the believers saw the confederate forces, they said, this is what Allah and His Messenger had promised us, and Allah and His Messenger told us what was true. And it only added to their faith and their zeal in obedience. Chapter 33, verse 22. It means that when we face a difficult circumstance, we should not become agitated, and we should not make others agitated. This is what Allah and His Messenger had promised us.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah.
As the global population is sharply growing, one commodity is in sharp decline: water. According to the World Bank, the population growth together with climate change will result in water scarcity, something researchers say will pose all kinds of problems and threats. In essence, almost everything depends on water. Mankind, animals, energy, and even land. As countries mark World Water Day, many governments around the world have been organizing campaigns to raise awareness that every drop counts. In Brazil, under the waters of many of Rio de Janeiro's coastline lies trash from fishermen and locals. According to Brazilian environmentalists, this is seriously threatening the safety of the natural ecosystem. The South American country throws some 325,000 tons of plastic into the sea, and the pollution affects some 100 coastal lagoons of the Rio de Janeiro state coast. An environmental group has held a cleanup event. They are using scuba gear to pick up trash littering the bottom of the sea, an effort to protect the country's water and biodiversity.
It's already important as a commodity today. So if you don't think of water as an important commodity, it's probably because you live in an urban area or in a developed country where tap water is drinkable. But if you move out of these spaces, you'll realize how precious drinking water is.
Water is essential. Water is needed to drink, for hygiene and for agriculture. So water will be the basis of civilization, the basis of human life, for as long as we can foresee, and therefore water resources will be very important.
Researchers say the water sanitation problems in large swathes of the planet are a real danger. Rivers are running dry, lakes are being contaminated, and groundwater is being depleted. Growing demands from agriculture, energy production, and climate change are also contributing to the increasingly short supply of water. NGOs are doing their best to play a part too.
NGOs have spent a lot of money funded by donors to expand the supply network, to give access to people to water. So through the construction of wells and piped water systems, where the issue for my research is that money is not available for the maintenance and upkeep of these systems. So you might give people initial access to water, but how do you maintain that? How do communities maintain that access to water?
Experts say over the past decades, the best sources of drinking water have been severely degraded because of overuse and bad preservation management. From the United States to Australia to the Middle East, huge areas of the world are drying up. According to the World Health Organization, billions of people around the world are suffering from poor access to safe drinking water. There is a growing body of research suggesting that the shortage of this vital commodity will lead to armed conflicts between nations. International organizations are sounding the alarm about the dangers of territories being on the verge of an epic drought. Concern has been raised as to whether a lack of drinking water will lead to armed conflict between nations in the future.
There have been at times when water scarcity has led to serious international tensions. One example is in the Middle East between Syria, Jordan, and Israel over the Jordan River and the allocation of its water resources. That has not led to actual war, but it certainly led to an increase in political tensions.
I think any resource that is scarce can lead to wars, especially one that is so crucial to our lives. Even as of now, water has led to a lot of dispute, so I wouldn't...
By 2050, more than half of the global population is expected to face water stress. Water stress is when demand outweighs available water resources. More than 2 billion people live in countries experiencing water stress. 1 in 5 children worldwide do not have enough water to meet their daily needs. needs. 2 in 5 people worldwide, or 3 billion, do not have a hand washing facility with water and soap at home. Providing access to safe drinking water and sanitation in 140 low- and middle-income countries would cost $114 billion per year. Agriculture accounts for nearly 70% of global water withdrawals. Climate change is altering rainfall patterns, reducing water availability and worsening the damage caused by floods and droughts around the world. In a statement to mark the occasion, the European Union said access to sufficient, safe, acceptable, physically accessible and affordable water remains a challenge in many parts of the world. The bloc also warned that sustainable management of water resources requires global action through strong international cooperation, and that everyone needs to play their full part in ensuring inclusive access to water and sanitation worldwide.
U.S. President Joe Biden's administration has already started a war of words with countries it deems adversaries, namely North Korea, China, and Russia. The rhetoric between Washington and Beijing escalated after U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken's trip to South Korea and Japan, where he leveled allegations against China and North Korea, expressing concern about their activities. The first high-level in-person talks between top American and Chinese diplomats revealed the extent of the rift in their bilateral ties. The two-day meeting held in Alaska saw the two sides trading blows over a host of issues during the opening session, which usually takes minutes to complete, but in this case lasted for well over an hour. The Biden administration has also taken a hardline stance against the other U.S. rival, Russia, with the State Department threatening sanctions on any entity that would get involved in the development of the Nord Stream 2 project, a pipeline which would stretch from Russia to Germany. The U.S. has accused Russia of trying to influence the 2020 presidential election. In an interview, Biden said Russia will, quote, pay a price for attempting to meddle in the election, while suggesting that his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, was a killer.
The U.S. A big brother policy, if you want to call it that, is also targeting the Europeans, trying to stop the very important pipeline between Russia and Germany, and they're attacking the very interests of those people that they're trying to bring on board. All these countries have different relations with China and different relations with Russia, and we saw how the Europeans reacted, or didn't react, I would say, to Biden's, you know, outrageous claims that Putin was a killer. Nobody is backing him up, and I think they were very shocked by the words of the president, and they're not very happy with the results of that, and certainly doesn't represent their opinion.
Moscow, Beijing, and Pyongyang, on their part, have responded to the hostile remarks. Yet the fiery U.S. statements are reminiscent of foreign policy adopted by the hawkish administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump. Pyongyang was quick to respond to the U.S. threats. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un's influential sister on Tuesday warned the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden against, quote, causing a stink at its first step if it wanted to sleep in peace for the next 4 years. Kim Yo-jong, who is a key advisor to her brother, denounced the annual joint U.S.-South Korea military drills, which began earlier this month, saying war drills and hostility can never go with dialogue and cooperation. But the U.S. later clarified its position on North Korea, with Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin saying Washington was ready to, quote, fight tonight. U.S. officials' incendiary remarks prompted a response from China as well. Beijing has noted that the U.S. has no longer the qualification to speak to China from a position of power. In the meantime, Russian President Vladimir Putin hit back at Biden, who had called him a killer, saying it takes one to know one. Also, Russia recalled its ambassador to the U.S. for consultations.
So the U.S. is playing a very dangerous game because they think that they're leading this big troop of international nations to meet the so-called autocracies, i.e. Russia and China, whereas I think if they look behind them, they're going to see that their army is quickly fading and disappearing and going their own way. But it's a dangerous situation because they're pursuing that. The United States is still, you know, probably militarily, undoubtedly, the most powerful country in the world. They could bring the world to war, and that's where the danger is. But I think most of the other countries are rational enough to understand that pursuing a path of trying to contain or delimit or even undermine the sovereign governments of Russia and China, or either one of those, is a very dangerous game that will only lead to military conflict. And I think they're not going to be on board that policy.
Many observers expected the Biden era to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies. Just over 2 months into his presidency, however, Biden has set the tone for what the world can expect for at least the next 4 years.
September 11, 2001. Two hijacked airplanes were flown directly to the twin World Trade Center buildings in New York City. 3 days later, U.S. Congress passed a resolution which has been used to justify Washington's military interventions abroad and detentions in Guantanamo Bay prison since. The authorization of the use of military force, or AUMF, granted the U.S. President the authority to use force against those who were involved in the 9/11 attacks. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. According to the Cost of War Project reports, since 2003, over 9.2 million Iraqis have been displaced across the country or have become refugees abroad. Washington is also responsible for around 300,000 deaths in Iraq between 2003 and 2009, a figure that could be much higher. Over two-thirds were civilians. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. That's while during the 2016 presidential campaigns, the former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. But Washington's acts did not end there. In 2020, four members of the U.S. private military firm Blackwater were pardoned. That is while Blackwater's mercenaries were prosecuted and found guilty of multiple criminal acts committed during a 2007 massacre at Nisr Square in Baghdad, which left 17 unarmed civilians dead and at least 20 wounded. The U.S.-led war in Iraq has had its negative impact on American people's lives as well. U.S. taxpayers have paid nearly $2 trillion in war-related costs on the Iraq War alone. That's an average of $8,000 per person and represents 9% of the national debt.
What the U.S. intended to do in Iraq is exactly what we see right now. The outcome that they were looking for is the destruction of the country, its continuous chaos in this country, in order for them to loot all the resources at the lowest cost.
A recent report published by the Cost of War Project says the U.S. military has conducted so-called counter-terror activities in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. The U.S. troops have also conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Moreover, Washington owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That is while China is the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. The ongoing war on terror has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and over 335,000 civilians have lost their lives.
The war on terrorism is a war for terrorism, when in reality, the terrorism being created by the United States the intended target is the destruction of the Arab and Muslim people.
After spending over $6.4 trillion and ruining lives of millions during the War on Terror campaign, Washington has failed to win a single war as of yet. With that, why does Washington fail to learn its lesson? The U.S. should correct the course now by repealing the 2002 AUMF.
The United States and China have held their first high-level in-person talk since President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office in Alaska on Thursday. The growing rift between the two nations was made evident before the media as diplomats traded barbs during the opening session, a formal function in diplomatic talks that's supposed to take minutes, which in this case lasted for an hour. U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken said the issue of Hong Kong, Taiwan, cyber attacks on United States, blame on China, and what he called Beijing's economic coercion toward Washington's allies would be discussed during the two-day talks. In response, China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi slammed the U.S. for interfering in Beijing's internal affairs. The official also lashed out at Washington for what he called its struggling democracy and poor treatment of minorities. He also sharply criticized the U.S. foreign and trade policy. Blinken accused China of grandstanding during the public meeting, while his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi slammed the U.S., quote, inhospitality.
I think that the Chinese representatives were not expecting a friendly meeting, but I think we're surprised by the how intensely aggressive and hostile the statements were coming from the U.S. side. The Biden administration's attitude toward China and orientation toward China is even more hostile and belligerent and aggressive than was Trump. Every day there's something new.
Experts also believe the first major meeting between the two superpowers suggests that a reset of ties is not in the cards for the foreseeable future. During the bitter talks, the United States accused China of human rights violations. The Chinese foreign minister was quick to respond. He noted that the U.S. no longer has the qualification to speak to China from a position of strength, adding that many Americans have little confidence in the U.S. democracy.
In the United States, police kill over 1,100 people on the average year, and that's over the last 6 years. That's three a day. There's no other advanced capitalist country, developed capitalist country, that comes even close. Canada's the next one. And the U.S. rate is four times Canada's, but it's 27 times the rate in Germany and 67 times the rate of police killing in England and Wales. So those are very serious violations of human rights. There's great poverty in large sections of the U.S. and no prospects for getting better. That's a violation of human rights. So this very condescending attitude that the U.S. representatives are taking, and their idea that they can lecture others about human rights in the world, is I think much refuted by people all over the world, their governments and people all over the world today.
As part of his go-it-alone policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump provoked an all-out trade war with China, imposing several rounds of tariffs against billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports, a move that Beijing retaliated. The Trump administration also sanctioned several Chinese officials and major companies over a variety of different allegations, ranging from human rights violations to threatening the U.S. national security. During the 2020 U.S. presidential campaign, Trump's fellow Republicans feared that Joe Biden would adopt a soft stance on China. However, top Republicans have in recent weeks voiced approval of Biden's attempts to reset relations with Washington's allies and uniting them against China. Although the Biden administration is yet to clearly define its China policy, the opening of the first major meeting between the two sides served as a preview of what lies ahead for the two nations for at least the next 4 years.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
The first type of right that Imam Sajjad alayhi salam speaks about in his treatise is the right of God, the right of Allah, Haqqullah.
For Humanity, a commentary on Risalatul Huquq of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. Sayyid Wahid Alawi. An Islamic scholar with 16 years of Hawza studies.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome once again to the program For Humanity on IRIB English Radio. We were talking about one of the rights in the book, The Treatise of Rights, from Imam Ali Zainul Abidin, the son of Al Husayn alayhim as-salam, where he states in the right of him whose advice you seek, وَأَمَّا حَقُّ الْمُشِيرِ إِلَيْكَ فَلَا تَتَّهِمْهُ بِمَا يُوقِفُكَ عَلَيْهِ مِنْ رَأْيِهِ. And the right of him whose advice you seek is that you should not accuse him when he gives you advice which does not conform to your own opinion. Why is that so? Because it is quite natural that opinions are different and people have various views about their affairs in different topics in which they disagree. And the Imam continues and says, you're free not to accept his advice if you doubt it. However, you are not permitted to accuse him of providing you with ill advice as long as you consider him to be of those worthy of consultation. Here the Imam alayhi salam is again referring back to suspicion and bad intention towards others, towards our brothers and sisters, and we were talking about suspicion and its diseases, and part of those things that we mentioned was psychological pressure in the form of stress, anger and grudge which it brings with it, and other symptoms as fear and uncertainty and bad self-confidence and greed and stinginess. All of these are symptoms of suspicion which the Imam talks about in the right of him who seeks your advice, and that you are not allowed to insult him or to have suspicion towards him when he gives you an advice, an honest advice, even if it is against your opinion. And now we reach the part where I was going through the negative attributes or effects suspicion has on the society in its whole and among people. Number one, it ruins friendship and peace among people. The hadith says, if suspicion takes over a person's thoughts and mind, peace and friendship between him and his friends will never take place. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, the one who has good and positive thoughts on people will be able to get their friendship. In another hadith, he says, a human being who has the disease of suspicion is always sick. And again, it is referring back to what we mentioned earlier about the psychological pressure in the form of stress, anger, and grudge that these people carry with them when they have suspicion towards others. Su'ud-dhan, which the Noble Quran mentions. And again, in another hadith, the one who is inflicted by suspicion doesn't have faith, doesn't have iman. We will continue, inshallah, after the break with this interesting topic, so please join us afterwards.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome, dear listeners, to the program For Humanity. We're talking about the right of him whose advice you seek, where the Imam very clearly states that you should not accuse the one who gives you an honest advice and is against your own opinion. You should not accuse him, and you should not have a bad intention towards him, which we call for suspicion or su'ud-dhan. The Noble Quran says in this regard, in Surah Al-Hujurat, chapter 49, verse 12, O you who believe, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا اجْتَنِبُوا كَثِيرًا مِنَ الظَّنِّ إِنَّ بَعْدَ الظَّنِّ إِثْمٌ. O you who believe, avoid most suspicion. Some suspicion is sinful. And we were talking about the bad effects of this disease, and we mentioned a couple of ahadith, and I will continue, inshallah. And we have as number two, those who lie. The negative attributes or effects of suspicion was that it ruins friendship and peace among people. And now we'll continue with the people whom you shouldn't seek advice from. Number one, those who lie. These people, says Imam Ali alayhi salam, are like the mirage in the desert. When you come close, you don't find anything. These people lie, and their nature is lying. So you should not seek advice from these kind of people. Number two, those who are chickens. They are afraid. They are cowards, basically. Those people you should also avoid of seeking advice from. The reason for that is that a person who is a coward never starts or ends a task. He is always too afraid to trigger you to start a task, because he himself, his nature is like that. Number three, the ones who have a lot of greed, because they will simplify tribulations for you and adorn and beautify greed for you. Number four, those who are cheap and stingy, because they will stop you to do good towards others. They will stop you to give sadaqah, alms, to others, the needy, the oppressed, and the destitute of the nations. That's all for today, dear brothers and sisters. I hope that you enjoyed the program for humanity. And as always, you can forward your questions and suggestions to us through English Radio at irib.ir. And you can also listen to us through parstoday.com. Till next time, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon all of you.
صلي يا ربي على طه الأمين رحمة أرسلته للعالمين وعلى آل النبي أجمعين فبهم نرجوك أحسن ختمنا.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin from the British capital. My name's Amina Taylor, and we kick things off. Well, here, because further escalation in the dispute between China and Western powers as sanctions are traded in a tit-for-tat exchange over alleged human rights abuses. But as Murtaza Jaffa reports, other factors look to be underlying this growing deterioration.
Tensions are growing, sanctions are being imposed, and the rhetoric is ramping up on all sides. Over the past few hours, China has responded to sanctions from the EU, UK, Canada, and the US in kind with sanctions of its own. Speaking to the media, China's deputy ambassador to the UK voiced strong opposition to Western pressure, slamming accusations of human rights abuse as cause for unilateral sanctions.
Sanctions will be useless to China. You know, it will only unite the Chinese people. And the basic response I heard is that the officials feel honored to be sanctioned by the US, EU, or